You are listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, a Wisconsin doctor answers your questions about COVID-19. Now, while fitness culture has existed in America for decades, today's version of it can seem amplified, with Instagram fitness influencers promoting their own product lines from workout guides to barbell pads, a flooded supplement market with products like fat burners, and wellness brands and exercise classes with marketing that makes exercise look cool or maybe just overwhelming. The point being, the fitness industry is big, and we're trying to figure out, is it all hype? What were just more ways to spend our money? Or are more of us actually working out and getting healthier? Natalia Petrozella is an historian and contemporary American politics and culture, and also an associate professor of history at the New School. She's a journalist and author with a forthcoming book on American fitness culture called Fit Nation: How America Embraced Exercise as the Government Abandoned It. Natalia, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Okay, so is this bigger than ever, or does it just feel like it?
It is definitely bigger than ever. There's no question. I mean, I think that we can see over the last 75 years or so, fitness culture kind of expanding in the U.S. Throughout, but definitely today, we see fitness in almost every aspect of our life, from fashion to, education to digital technologies. So yes, it is getting bigger and bigger, but I think it's important to realize that doesn't mean that we as a nation are getting fitter and fitter. And I think that's a really important distinction.
Okay, so explain that. The fitness industry is bigger, but we're not getting more fit. What?
Right. So, I know it seems not to make sense. Well, if you look at the data, I mean, there hasn't actually been a boom in Americans of all socioeconomic backgrounds getting more fit and having more access to fitness and recreation options. So even as our culture, even as the business and the industry has boomed, it's really remained a private market. And so we've actually seen massive cuts in public physical education and in community recreation activities. And so it's no mystery when you see that, more Americans might be more active than ever, but they're concentrated in higher socioeconomic classes. That has everything to do with that privatization.
And when you say privatization, what are you talking about here when it comes to fitness?
Yeah, I'm talking about the fact that fitness is primarily accessible through a private market, through industries, through going to a gym that you pay a membership for, through a product that you order, online and that comes to your home, that we can't really rely in this country. And it's never been perfect, by the way, but it's been better in some moments. We can't really rely on the fact that you'll go to school as a kid and you'll have enough physical education that it will help you be, meaningfully healthy and also foster a lifelong love of exercise. We can't rely on the fact that the neighborhoods most Americans live in are close to a park or are safe enough to run outside or have a running trail nearby. Actually, those neighborhoods that have that tend to be in the kind of neighborhoods where a lot of people have enough money to buy into private options. So that's what I mean.
Yeah. And although maybe our mindset has changed some, I think most people think exercise is a good idea. We usually don't consider people who exercise to be weird, but exercise was not always mainstream. I mean, several decades ago, it was only for certain people. How was that?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's a big part of the story that I'm trying to tell beyond this inequality angle, which is that today, even though we're not a very fit nation, most people think working out is virtuous. Like, even when I say I'm a historian writing this book, people are like, oh, I should go to the gym more. I'm like, I'm not the police, but that feeling that that's the right thing to do is of relatively recent vintage. And if you look even in like the 1950s or into the 1960s, if you were someone who exercised regularly, who was not an athlete or, not in the image business as an actor or someone who's like on screen, it was considered very strange. Men were considered suspicious that it wasn't really masculine to care so much about your body and what you looked like and to want to keep the company of other sweaty men so frequently. So it was a real sort of, blow to mainstream masculinity to be someone who exercised frequently. And then related to that, many women who were into particularly weightlifting were seen as compromising their femininity, compromising their fertility. And if you lift weights or if you run long distances, you're not going to be able to have babies. And what kind of woman would risk that? That two, you will develop muscular muscles, which make you unattractive and manly. And then three, and I think this is super interesting, that athletics and fitness as well, it cultivates an unladylike sensibility. This will make you too individualistic. This will make you too ambitious. And that's not what girls and women should be like. So, you know,
there's a lot there.
Yeah, and they haven't left us completely, but I think it's really surprising to most people that, you know, I should go to the gym was not an expression of like positive character not that long ago.
Natalia Pedrazella is an historian of contemporary American politics and culture, and her new book about fitness culture is called Fit Nation: How America Embraced Exercise as the Government Abandoned It. Your calls are welcome at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about how our culture has shifted when it comes to fitness? Do you want to talk about the role of fitness in schools or in our daily lives or based on gender? We're here for you at 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Natalia, you've got this book about American fitness culture ongoing. When we say culture, describe that for us, because that includes more than just going to the gym a few times a week or attending a spin class. What is culture really about?
Yeah, and I should say I'm still writing the book, so it'll come out next year, I plan. But so I use fitness culture because it's in part a way of expressing in shorthand the way fitness is in every part of our lives now, right? This isn't just a kind of narrow history of, say, Muscle Beach or the rise of commercial gyms. This is about the way fitness has become an ethos for many Americans, even if it's one that we kind of fail to meet.
We even see brands, we can name off the top of our head, Lululemon being one of the most well-known that have popped up to serve specifically this growing industry. So fitness fashion is now a thing that's part of this culture.
Absolutely. And that's part of a kind of conspicuous consumption, right? The idea that you don't just go to the gym, you post about it, you wear clothes that advertise you're on the way to the gym or on the way back from the gym. I think Lululemon was really kind of led the way in making athleisure clothing that made gym wear kind of public and also expensive. It became another thing to spend money on. If you read books about fitness in the 1960s or 70s, they all say, like, just find some old clothes you no longer wear to work. I mean, there was no industry for it at that time.
Right. Except now we see it as not only is there a high price point on some of these brands, but they signal something to everybody else around.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They signal affluence. They signal discipline. They signal virtue. They're also often tight. So they signal like a lot of whatever your body looks like. Right. They're definitely a kind of performance.
We're talking with Natalia Pedrazella, who is an historian of contemporary American politics and culture, also an associate professor of history at the New School. She's also a journalist and an author. And we're talking about fitness culture in today's world and the huge growth of this industry. And we want to hear from you. There's a line for you at 800-642-1234. Have you noticed more people in your life, maybe including you, become more interested in fitness and exercise? Are you a participant in fitness culture? Do you go to classes? Do you like to dress the part? What do you see changing? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Our conversation about fitness culture continues here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Keeley Boltina. We're talking about the current fitness industry, what fitness culture looks like in today's world. Our guest is Natalia Pedrazella. She's writing the book Fit Nation: How America Embraced Exercise as the Government Abandoned It. And we want to hear from you. 800-642-1234. Are you spending more of your money on fitness and wellness-related things? Supplements, vitamins, athletic clothes, classes, and passes classes for gyms. Maybe you've been going to a gym or attending fitness classes for a while now. What have you seen change? Call 800-642-1234 or drop us a tweet at Central Time WPR. Natalia, we're talking about the fashion as far as the fitness culture goes, but there's also this component that could probably be an entirely different discussion, and that's food and snack market growth in relation to people's interest in wellness. This is a huge deal.
Oh, it is a huge deal. And it could be in another episode or maybe three other episodes. But we could come at this from a variety of angles, but I definitely think, of course, you can't talk about fitness without food. And I think that it's no accident that fast food exploded in the 1980s at the same time that there was a big boom in fitness as well. And in some ways, I think that is based on a fallacy a lot of people still believe, which is that you can out-exercise a bad diet. And any fitness trainer will tell you that's not the case. But I think that in many ways, as Americans have become less healthy, that kind of insecurity and worry and, laudable desire to invest money in something like your own health has created this space for the fitness industry to boom. Because if you're eating fast food a lot, it's, that's the most affordable thing for a lot of people. That's going to affect your health. And then you're also a prime target for a fitness industry, which is ready to say, hey, we'll sell you something else. And that's going to make you healthy. And that's a pretty damaging cycle.
Historically, though, have granola bars and protein supplements and all kinds of seeds that you add to your smoothies, have those always gone hand in hand with exercise and fitness?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yes. People talked about the health nuts, quote unquote, in the early 20th century, who were people who were both into who were really into bodily experimentation. And that meant intense exercise, yoga at a time when no one in the US pretty much did yoga, and also natural foods, right? Plant-based diets. If you were a vegetarian in the early 20th century, you were very strange. Similarly to if you lifted weights or if you did yoga, and those things definitely came together. So we've always seen that connected, but the kind of commodification and commercialization of the energy bar and, all kinds of other supplements, that's much more recent. And in many ways is part of the co-optation of what was once anti-capitalist into the industry.
So they're finding ways to leverage how people are acting to make money then.
Yes. That is the American story of basically everything, and fitness is no exception.
That's fair. Let's go ahead and bring in a caller. Danny from Milwaukee is with us now. Hi, Danny.
Hi. I just wanted to comment and get your guest comments on the connection that our society and the fitness industry has made on fitness models and them being extremely healthy and us wanting to be cut and lean. And when in all reality, those low body fat percentages are not actually healthy for women or men, but in particularly body image for women.
Oh, Danny, thank you so much for bringing that up. What do you think, Natalia?
Yeah, Danny, that is such a great point. And, I do a lot of kind of fitness activism, too. And one of my main commitments, particularly when I work with women, is to separate the idea that any particular look signifies fitness or health. Because I think, as Danny brings up, that's so problematic. A lot of what we consider to be healthy in this culture is not actually healthy or not necessarily healthy. And I think, the industry is changing in a lot of ways, but it's in very many ways perpetuated the idea that weight loss should be everyone's primary fitness goal and that being thin is synonymous with being fit. That is absolutely not true.
How does the online piece fit into this then? Because we do see the internet, we do see those connections, social media, Instagram, really having a strong foothold in this area.
Yeah, I think, depending on the mood I'm in, I come off really optimistic or pessimistic about the role of the online role in shaping fitness culture, particularly around body image. I think that, look, there's no shortage of really damaging stuff out there, which is selling people who have no expertise, giving bad advice, selling bad topics, bad products, and perpetuating the idea that if you have this, corset you work out in, or if you have a particular body, that means that you're fit. On the other hand, We cannot ignore the way that, you know, what was once called the body positive movement, although that's been a little bit discredited, but, you know, we cannot, I think, devalue the way that social media in particular has welcomed many more kinds of bodies. And I mean, age, ability, race, gender. The internet has been amazing in doing that. And we've actually seen mainstream media have to kind of keep up, even in a halting way. You know, the fact that these women's magazines no longer use the term bikini body anymore seems almost quaint, but that is totally a result of these online influencers who really said, you know, fit bodies can look a whole variety of ways. And so I do think there's a very positive story about the role of social media in this as well.
Natalia Petrozella is an historian of contemporary American politics and culture, and we're talking about fitness culture here. There's still time for you if you have a question or a comment here at 800-642-1234. Again, that number is 800-642-1234. Natalia, you want to stick with inclusivity in fitness culture? We saw back in the 1920s, YMCAs open to encourage men to exercise and use them. In the 70s and 80s, women joined in with things like jazzercise and aerobics. How has this demographic of who participates in exercise changed culturally?
It's expanded a lot. As I mentioned earlier in the interview, if you were someone who wanted to exercise regularly, even in the 50s or early 60s, that was very strange. We have seen basically the expansion of exercise to include anyone who can pay for it, honestly. And that's not to say that every space is equally inclusive of people who are older or who have larger bodies or who are ethnic and racial minorities or who are women. I mean, there's a whole lot of interesting work, for example, showing that like women are still feel less welcome and uncomfortable on the weightlifting part of gym floors and tend to flock to studios, right? That there are all kinds of forms of like informal segregation that go on that keep certain places very white in particular. But I think that, you know, if you look at a fitness club in the 1980s, I think that a lot of people would say, you know, those are places where you look like you already have to be fit to go there. Now, one of the biggest demographics for gym memberships are people over 55. I mean, that in itself is a really, really big difference. So I think that is a positive thing, that more people feel welcome in the pursuit of becoming healthier and more fit in these particular spaces and more broadly. But I wish that we could extend that socioeconomically, because the inclusivity of a lot of these spaces stops the second it involves letting people in the door who can't pay often very hefty fees. And that's a real issue.
So with these fitness companies and these flashy brands, I mean, they want us to support them through their dollars. Does that detract from the larger goal of getting healthier and being more active? Or is that just part of it and can be empowering that when you pull on your Lululemon leggings, you feel like you can do it?
Yes. I mean, I've actually written an article like that a long time ago. I was a Lululemon ambassador. I don't think we talked about it, but I teach fitness as well. So I'm like really in this. I am not so judgy that I want to say that just because something is, you know, a capitalist product, it doesn't mean that real good doesn't come from it. Absolutely. There's no question. But I think that I think it is important for all of us to kind of take a note of pause and look around the spaces that we enjoy, whether it's a Lululemon store or a particular gym or studio, and just ask ourselves, who's in this room and who's not in this room? Why is that? How am I perpetuating that inclusion or exclusion? What can I do differently? I just think the gym is such a big part of American life right now, figuratively and literally, that we've got to take it seriously as a site, like schools, like housing, like all kinds of other places where inequalities, real meaningful ones, are also perpetuated, and to fight them accordingly. So that's kind of the hill I'll die on.
We can't talk about health right now today without acknowledging that COVID-19 is absolutely affecting the fitness industry. Yeah. We see gyms and yoga studios closing down to try to make sure that their patrons can stay safe. How does that fit into this story?
Oh my, it's such a strange chapter right now. I mean, yeah, I'm talking to you from New York City, and gyms are completely shut down in New York. And I think that that is a very hard thing for a lot of New Yorkers to wrap their heads around, because here's this kind of space, which has always been seen as a kind of reprieve, as a kind of good place to go to promote your own health. And now we're being told, quite rightfully so, you can't go to those places because it's unhealthy to go there, right? Because you could contract or spread this virus. And so what we're seeing today is all those in real life places shut down, but a huge boom in digital fitness. And I'm happy to see in free digital fitness. I mean, I can't count the number of emails in my inbox about either individual entrepreneurs or you know, businesses that are opening up for 30 days or more doing free online exercise. And I think that's wonderful because, you know, a lot of these places are very small businesses, which are very strapped and really damaged by losing this kind of income. So I think that's important to see too. We're all wrapped up in, you know, the perils and the promises of this fitness industry.
Yeah, Natalia, any advice for people wanting to stay active or get fit while we're also being told remain at home whenever possible?
Yeah, well, I would definitely kind of key into wherever you'd like to go when you can go outside and see if your favorite studios or gyms are offering online workouts. I will say I didn't come on this to promote here, but I am teaching a class on Thursday for free at noon Eastern called Intensati, which is really fun. And you can get that on the Intensati YouTube channel. But I think really looking into the things you already like and then seeing what they're offering online is awesome. Also, depending where you are, going for a run or a walk outside in a non-crowded place. I ran 10 miles today, which I have not done in a very long time, but just I was grateful for the fresh air. So, yeah.
Right. So maybe not so much running in groups right now or participating in those group classes, but finding ways to still get a little bit of exercise into your day wherever you can.
Yeah, it is crucial. We need our mental health and our physical health more than ever right now. And I worry that that's going to fall to the wayside for a lot of people who are cooped up inside. But let's do our best, but also not beat ourselves up if we drop our training regimes, because it's almost impossible to do what you thought you were going to do this week, given what's going on.
Yeah, and we just have a minute left. But this idea that, you know, I should, if I can't run 10 miles today, then I might as well give up and sit on the couch. I suspect that you think there's some middle ground.
Absolutely. And I should say, I like never run 10 miles. It was very strange that I did so today. So I feel the need to announce it on live radio.
Full disclosure.
Yeah, exactly. So, right. I think that's absolutely important. Like this class I'm teaching on Thursday online is 30 minutes and it doesn't have to be rigorous. But I think getting out of your desk, moving around, moving your body in whatever way feels good to you, but maybe, you know, you need a little more of an oomph to do it. Here is your oomph. Get up and move. Everybody in your life will be happier for it.
Natalia, thank you so much for joining us. Natalia Petrozella is an historian of contemporary American politics and culture, and she's also a journalist and author. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow after 7 on the morning show, we don't have to look far to see photos of empty shelves and long lines. We're talking about consumer behavior amid the global COVID-19 pandemic. That's tomorrow on the morning show from 6 until 9 here on the Ideas Network. Now, we've been getting many questions from listeners through our Wisconsin portal on Facebook and email, and of course in calls to our talk shows here on the Ideas Network. And we're doing our best to answer your questions in the days and weeks to come. Today, Dr. Jeff Potthoff. He's the chief quality officer for UW Health. Dr. Potthoff, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today.
Awesome. Thanks, Keely, for having me.
First, we know this number is changing rapidly, but how many people have been diagnosed with COVID-19 in Wisconsin?
I believe the number right now is 72, but like you said, that could change by the end of the day.
And how does our testing rate affect that number?
So testing rate's important because if we have difficulty with testing some people, we may miss the true positive rate of COVID-19 in our communities.
Okay, so are we testing everyone with symptoms, or what's the status when it comes to testing in Wisconsin?
Unfortunately not. We are still seeing some shortages, sometimes with the test kits and sometimes the reagents, so the chemicals that we use when the lab runs the test, so much so that we've been having to prioritize who gets the test so that we use tests on individuals who are most likely to benefit. So I think we saw recommendations from the Department of Public Health today. At UW Health, we've been doing this for a while now, whereby the most important person we want to test is someone who is already ill enough to require hospitalization. We'd want to know if that individual is affected by COVID-19 or not. We also prioritize healthcare workers, and this may sound funny on the surface, but what we don't want to have happen is a healthcare worker be infected with COVID-19, go to work, not know it, and potentially transmit that to another person. And the second reason we test healthcare workers is because we need all of our doctors and nurses on the front lines during this time. And the sooner we can kind of know that they're not COVID positive, the quicker we can try to get them back to work. A third group is high-risk patients, so individuals who are older, say over the age of 60, over the age of 70, who have those comorbid conditions we've been talking about, heart disease, lung disease, those individuals who may have a more difficult course if they're COVID positive, we would want to test those. If we had unlimited testing, we'd also want to test individuals who have, you know, fever, dry cough, kind of the normal symptoms, but otherwise are younger, they're for the most part healthy, they'd be able to do just fine at home. In an ideal world, we'd want to test them so we know the total number of positives, but because we don't have enough tests and we know that we wouldn't change treatment even if we knew if they were COVID positive 19 or not, those are individuals who aren't being tested in large quantities at this time.
So how should we think about then the number 72 at this stage? I mean, it sounds like it's likely we have more positives in Wisconsin. We just haven't confirmed them.
Yeah, I think at this point, the number becomes less relevant. I think when we were thinking about a containment strategy where we could identify individuals who had traveled or had an exposure and then identify them in the community, it's interesting at that juncture to know a number. I think today with the announcement that there's community spread, I think we just have to think that anyone could really have this. And if I have symptoms that are consistent with COVID-19, I should probably assume that I have the virus until take the steps that I need to keep everyone else in my home safe and healthy. So isolate myself, make sure I wash my hands regularly, things like that.
And speaking of that, if someone is exposed to the virus, how would they show symptoms?
Yeah, so we do know that the most common symptom is a dry cough, and I think that we are seeing that in over like 70% of cases. Another common symptom is fever. Initial reports had that in like 60% of patients. There's some reports now saying that maybe it's a little bit less than that. And then other things that we're seeing are sore throat. That's a pretty common symptom. Body aches and fatigue. And then surprisingly, runny nose, maybe not as often, but just because you have a runny nose, that wouldn't mean that you couldn't have COVID. COVID-19.
Okay, but not necessarily one of the ways that you could know that it's a potential that it's what you're dealing with.
Yeah, I think the hard part with COVID-19 is a lot of these symptoms we've just listed off are similar to just about any other viral upper respiratory tract infection. So you could have the flu. We saw a lot of that. We test people for influenza when they think they have COVID-19. It actually ends up being influenza because we still have a little bit of that around. And then there's a whole bunch of other viruses that can cause mild symptoms, but early on, you wouldn't really know the difference.
What about this idea of being a vector, carrying the virus, not actually knowing it, not showing symptoms?
Yeah, so we hear about this a lot, and we do know that it is possible to transmit COVID-19 when you're asymptomatic, so before you become symptomatic. We don't think that the rate of transmission or infectivity is nearly as high, so although people who are asymptomatic can transmit the virus, we don't think they can transmit it as easily as someone who is actively symptomatic with a fever or a cough or active symptoms. And then the same is true on the other side, what we call convalescence. When you no longer have a fever, we do believe there's a period of time, maybe a couple days, where you could still transmit virus, but probably much less effectively than when you're actually symptomatic.
But it does sound like then that there's a pretty significant window when someone could be contagious.
There is a pretty significant window, and that's what's so difficult with COVID-19 and why I think we have all these social distancing practices in place, because just feeling fine probably isn't good enough. You could feel fine but still infect people. We know that's especially true in younger people and in children.
Dr. Jeff Potthoff is Chief Quality Officer for UW Health, and we're talking about COVID-19 right now, answering some of your questions that have come in through Wisconsin. You can also give us a call right now at 800-642-1234 to ask the doctor your question about COVID-19, how it spreads, what precautions you should take. We're taking those calls now at 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Potthoff, we've had a lot of questions about how long this novel coronavirus can live on hard surfaces. What is that length of time?
I still think we're figuring it out. So I've seen reports that are as long as 9 days. With coronaviruses in general, they don't typically do well on surfaces. So I think in the coming months, we'll know longer how long they survive, and then how long they survive but are resilient enough where they can cause infection should you contaminate yourself with them. We do know that there is at least a period of time where they can live on surfaces like doorknobs, tabletops. So we are encouraging folks to wipe those things down with disinfectant wipes on a fairly regular basis, especially if you're having symptoms, URI symptoms or COVID-19 symptoms.
Yeah, what about things like clothing?
They don't do as well on clothing, so I haven't heard too many reports of concern of a lot of transmission on clothing. We do use gowns to protect patients in the hospital. Healthcare workers wear those gowns. So I imagine that it's not a zero risk, but I think it's much lower than hard surfaces like that.
You know, for people without health insurance, there's always a concern about unexpected or high costs when it comes to care. If someone doesn't have insurance and they're concerned they might have COVID-19, what should they do?
Yeah, I think if they're concerned that they have COVID-19, and just like anyone else who maybe does have health insurance, if you think you have COVID-19, but you're handling it well, and we know that 82% of people will be able to get through COVID-19 without seeking medical treatment, it is okay to take over-the-counter medications and isolate yourself in the home. If, however, you are having severe shortness of breath and you're becoming concerned, it would be appropriate to seek out medical care at that time. And I don't think we have all the details worked out exactly on how the billing is going to work with that and whether the government will step in, but I certainly wouldn't encourage someone to not seek out care if they feel like they can't breathe just based on their health insurance status.
Okay, so if you really do need to see a doctor, see a doctor.
Yeah.
Absolutely. We have Kryn from Green Bay on the line with a question now. Hi, Kryn.
Hi. I was just calling because I was wondering, you mentioned that you haven't been testing everyone who's come with symptoms, mostly younger people, and I was wondering how many people, if you have a number, have there been?
Interesting. Trying to kind of get some context to this. Thanks for the question, Kryn. Dr. Potthoff?
Yeah, so for people that we've tested, it's well into the hundreds, and that's been limited a little bit by the early testing. We are hopeful that we can get improved testing in the very near future. It's one of our top priorities, and if that were the case, we may be able to, you know, triple or quadruple the number of people who are being tested.
Any guess on the number of people that we've had to turn away from our healthcare institutions because of those limited tests?
I actually don't have the number on that. I'm not sure. Lots of times we take their name and then we sometimes try to follow up later for testing, but I know even that's getting less possible given the constraint on testing.
All right. Sounds good. Our conversation with Dr. Jeff Potthoff continues here. He is Chief Quality Officer for UW Health, and he's with us now to answer your medical questions about COVID-19. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about COVID-19? Maybe you've heard some conflicting information that Dr. Potthoff might be able to sort through with us. 800-642-1234. You can also submit questions through our Wisconsin project by going to the WPR.org homepage. Our conversation continues in just a bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina. We're talking with Dr. Jeff Potthoff. He's the Chief Quality Officer for UW Health, and he's with us to answer your medical questions about COVID-19. And let's go ahead and take another call. Let's go to Andy in Beaver Dam. Hi, Andy. What's your question?
Hi. I was wondering what the effects of coronavirus are on pregnant women.
Okay. Sounds great. Thanks, Andy. Dr. Potthoff, are pregnant women at a greater risk, or are they in that high-risk category?
So we have one study that's out of China that looks at pregnant women who got COVID-19. Unfortunately, it's a very small number of patients, like less than 10. So what we know is it doesn't seem like pregnant women are more susceptible to get COVID-19, but we're assuming that they would have slight increase as far as the severity of disease, but only based on the idea that that's a common thing that happens in most women who are pregnant. Their immune systems are just a little bit weaker. But to give like firm guidance or firm recommendations on what happens in pregnant women, we just don't know yet.
Yeah, Andy, thanks for the call and the question at 800-642-1234. There's a line for you and your medical question there, too. Now let's go ahead and welcome Nancy from Janesville. Nancy, what are you wondering today?
Yes, I'm wondering about, I'm a retired medical professional. I'm a PA, and my husband's a retired family doctor. We are concerned about the lack of reagent that a speaker just talked about, that there's not enough reagent to really do the tests. We know how easy this test is to do, that it's a pretty basic test, and we're just kind of appalled and wondering what does he think's going on that we don't have enough testing.
Okay, Nancy, thanks so much for that call. Dr. Potthoff, what is the problem? Why can't we get enough tests?
Yeah, no, I agree with Nancy. I think we just weren't prepared for the amount of reagent that we would need for these tests. There's just so many individuals that we would like to test and so many places in the U.S. that are trying to test that our supply chain just hasn't been able to keep up. So I think I share everyone's frustration with our inability to test everyone who we would like to test.
And when you say we, you're talking big picture we, not UW Health or Wisconsin.
Oh, yeah, right.
But
no,
all
big picture. Mm-hmm. I mean, the whole medical community in the United States wishes we could offer testing to anyone who would like it.
We also had a question from Matthew, who called 800-642-1234. Matthew in Madison asked, is this expected to go away during the summer months? Will warmer weather affect COVID-19? What do we know?
Yeah, so we can only hope. So when we look at other respiratory viruses and other COVID viruses, they oftentimes do have some seasonal variation where they start to decrease as our weather warms up. Sometimes they move to the southern hemisphere, who are experiencing winter when we experience summer, and then they can come back again in the fall. We see that often with influenza, but even with influenza, we don't see it every year. Sometimes we have influenza seasons that expand into the summer, and doctors and scientists don't understand that real well. So we all have our fingers crossed that this dies down in the summer months. But when we think about our planning efforts, we assume that it might be with us for a while.
Yeah. And what about this idea of reinfection? If someone is exposed to the novel coronavirus, whether it turns into the disease COVID-19 or not, does the person develop an immunity then? And if they get sick, can they get sick again?
Yeah, so this is a great question, and it's been studied a little bit more so in China. So we would assume that if you get infected with COVID-19, you would develop some degree of immunity to the virus. Unfortunately, with most coronaviruses, that immunity is somewhat short-lived. So if you think of the common head cold, all of us have had more than one common head cold. We're not exactly sure what will happen with COVID-19. We think we're aware of one case in China where someone became reinfected with it. Our best guess is that after you're infected with COVID-19, you probably have some degree of immunity, but for a period of time that we're not sure yet.
All right. Bob from Madison has a question for us. Good afternoon, Bob.
Good afternoon. I hope I can phrase this correctly, but if you come in contact with someone, then of course you don't want to spread it around. But how do you know, since we don't know who has it in like Dane County, which there was 10 or so, I think, how can you find out who has it?
Oh, yeah, good question, Bob, right? Because we don't, it's certainly one thing, Dr. Potthoff, if you know you've been in contact with someone who has a confirmed case of COVID-19, but we're with a lot of people who don't.
Yeah, that's true. And it's true that you really can't know who has it and who doesn't have it. It's easy if it's the person who is, you know, dripping of sweat, has a fever and is coughing. I think all of us would try to avoid that person. But we also know there's individuals who won't appear that sick, who may be infected with the virus. And that is really why we're recommending this social distancing. So whether someone looks healthy or not healthy, we're recommending you stay 6 feet away from them. And the reason is because the coronavirus, which is spread in kind of big droplets, If someone coughs or sneezes, it's rare for those particles to extend more than 6 feet from that person. And that's why we're recommending this social distancing to basically inhibit the spread, because we can't really tell who has it and who doesn't. Even the person who has it doesn't know.
Yeah, and you also have to be sensitive about it, but also not take it personally. I mean, our board operator, Sarah, and I have actually moved even farther apart today. We both appear to be completely healthy, but you just don't know.
You don't know, and it seems so unnatural, so you almost have to think about what you're doing, because it's just not like anything we've ever asked anybody to do before.
Right. All right. Carol from Duluth has a question, too. Carol, what are you wondering about COVID-19?
I'm wondering about the fever. Is it a low-grade fever, or do you get a real high fever? And what do you recommend, Tylenol or nothing or what? Thank you.
Oh, thanks, Carol. Yeah, how to define a fever. That's a struggle from the time you have a tiny baby in your house. You're trying to figure out what is a fever and what isn't.
So the official definition of fever is a temperature greater than 100.4 degrees. That's how we would define a fever, and that's how the fever is defined in these studies that we see. Obviously, before you have a fever of 100.4 degrees, you might be, you know, warmer than your 98.6, but that we don't typically define as a fever. As far as how to treat it, definitely recommend that people use Tylenol. There are some studies, and I'd say the medical evidence is incomplete on whether or not we should be avoiding ibuprofen or not. So with that said, I would suggest starting with Tylenol. And then if that doesn't work, I don't think there's a strong contraindication to ibuprofen. But if you can manage your fevers with ibuprofen, that's great. The most important thing to keep in mind, if you were to come down with COVID-19 and be self-isolating, is to stay hydrated. That seems kind of out of right field, but really the thing that we see people get the most in trouble with viral illnesses, and this includes influenza and other ones, they may be home, they may be doing okay, but they get dehydrated, and that actually makes them more sick than the virus themselves.
We're talking with Dr. Jeff Potthoff, who's the Chief Quality Officer for UW Health, and we're busting some myths and answering some questions about COVID-19. Then there is time for your question. If you email us at ideas@wpr.org, we might be able to incorporate it on the air here. John from Dodgeville has a question for us, too. Hi, John.
Yes, thanks for taking the call. The question is, I run a service business that requires employees to go into residential homes. We've asked them to wear rubber gloves. Should they also be wearing a mask?
Okay, thanks for that question, John. What do you think, Dr. Potthoff? Is a mask appropriate in this circumstance?
Boy, that's a hard question to ask or answer, because in most of these homes, it's unlikely you'll come in contact with someone who's going to cough on you. I think, and the other, just the practical limitation of it is it's going to be hard to find masks. So what can I advise people given those constraints? I think a good advice is if you enter those homes, you may want to try to stay farther away from those individuals. I'm not sure the service industry that you're in, but if you can stay 6 feet away, that's good. And also there's a time component. So if you're within proximity of individuals, but you're there for less than 10 minutes, we know transmission rates, infection rates are lower. So both try to distance yourself, decrease the time that you're in contact with people. Might be good suggestions in lieu of a mask, where if you were, you know, say a home health care provider who was going to take care of someone who had a URI type symptom in the home, we would want those individuals to be outfitted with a mask.
Okay, so it does depend on the work, and certainly we don't want to use masks when it's not necessary, especially as there's a shortage. So that makes the decision harder for different people running businesses. Mm-hmm. Matt from Nisita is on the line now. What's your question, Matt?
Hi there. Given the shortage of testing supplies, what is the CDC's recommendation for relatively young, healthy people with symptoms of COVID-19? Should they get tested, or should they just stay home and leave the testing supplies for the vulnerable?
Okay. Thanks, Matt. And Dr. Potthoff, what are we dealing with specifically younger people who are generally healthy but suddenly have these symptoms?
Yeah, and I'm not sure if the CDC has changed their guidance, but the guidance from the state and really the guidance from our special pathogen experts here are, if you're young and you're healthy and you're doing okay with the virus, so you feel a little down and out, maybe you've had a fever, but you're doing okay, I think at this point it's safe to assume that you may have COVID-19, and that likelihood still isn't 100%, but assume you might have COVID-19, isolate yourself and take care of yourself at home using over-the-counter medications, and we know that most people will recover just fine, usually in 7 days, sometimes up to 14 days, but usually on the shorter end of that. And they'll do just fine. So I think until we get the testing thing sorted out, that would be our recommendation, is if you otherwise wouldn't have gone to the hospital because you were worried about your breathing or getting a labs or a test, you don't need to with COVID-19 either.
And we aren't able to fit in this call, but Lisa from Wyawega does wonder, are there long-term health effects even if you recover? Dr. Potthoff, do we have any idea at this point?
You know, we don't. I mean, in December or November, this didn't exist. So this is brand new for all of us, and we just don't have the longitudinal studies to know what the long-term effects are. We do have other people who get the kind of end pulmonary or lung pathology that is associated with COVID-19, and those people can make full recoveries.
All right, Dr. Potthoff, we really appreciate your time. We have just scratched the surface, and we definitely thank you for helping us understand and get a better handle on COVID-19. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Keely. Appreciate the time, too.
Dr. Jeff Potthoff is Chief Quality Officer for UW Health, and many of these questions were informed by your submissions through the Wisconsin Project. We're working to answer more of those questions, so you can submit them online by going to WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, schools are shuttered amid the COVID-19 outbreak. We learn what the Federal Department of Education is doing and not doing for public schools. Wisconsin's governor has declared a public health emergency, but what does that really mean? Our WisConText team helps us with a deep dive into details of the declaration. And the first phase of the Encyclopedia of Milwaukee is live. We learn about the new comprehensive resource for all things about that city. That is up ahead on Central Time.